For some reason, I like doing this to read the scripture, and I can warn you in advance that there will not be slides for the morning. That just didn't happen. So, but what I like about reading the scripture in this way is I like what it does to what we say about the scripture. It kind of subjects us to the scripture. It places the scripture or God and what God has to say, perhaps say to us through the Spirit, as something beyond us. So if we can hear the scripture, just let it fall on our ears, and then we can talk later as a secondary sort of activity. So the scripture is from Luke chapter 9, and you can turn there rapidly if you would like. But if not, just hear it, which is what Christians for millennia have done, is just hear the scripture. Luke chapter 9, starting in verse 15. As the time approached for Jesus to be taken up into heaven, he resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. When the disciples James and John saw this, they asked, "Lord," this is what any rational person would ask, "Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to destroy them?" But Jesus turned and rebuked them. Then he and his disciples went to another village. This is the reading of the word of the Lord. You can be seated. When Chelsea and I first got married, well, first of all, you should know, before I say anything else, that we got married when we were 20. That's right, 20. 20 is a tough year to get married, mostly because you're kind of still an adolescent. Well, totally still an adolescent, is how it felt, at least. And so the first year, we went into marriage thinking that this is like the most delightful, most wonderful thing that could ever happen in our lives. And with lots of gratitude, we endeavored unto this activity. And then we very rapidly found that there was lots of hardship coming our way. And so it felt to us, and I don't think it feels this way to everyone. A lot of our friends didn't seem to strike marriage in the way that we did. But it felt to us that the honeymoon was short-lived. Later, I found out that there were certain things that we did in that first year that were annoying to my family in the honeymooner sort of way. So it's not that the honeymoon entirely left us, but it felt like there was struggle. It felt like we thought we were stepping into promised land, and instead we stepped into wilderness. Wilderness was all of a sudden upon us. And before I say more about wilderness, that's the series that we're in, by the way, if you're new here. We've been kind of grappling with wilderness as a congregation, and so that's what I'll be reflecting on this morning. So for me, the way I think about wilderness is that it is a response to a circumstance. It is a reaction to struggle. The way that you engage with the moment is relative to you. So what may strike one person in a way that's like fairly insignificant, manageable, relatively okay, for another person will feel like this is a serious problem. And there are a variety of reasons, I think, for that. It could have to do with personality. It could have to do with life experience. There are all sorts of things that could play a part in that struggle. But for us, the thing that happened, or the circumstances in that first year felt very much like wilderness. It was in that first year that we grabbed hold of a quote from this one guy. His name is Walter Brueggemann. He gets quoted around here sometimes. But there's this one quote that I read of his, and it got turned into like a refrigerator quote. And the quote goes like this: "Only those who anguish will sing new songs. Without anguish, the new song is likely to become strident and just more royal fakery." And so Chelsea and I kind of grabbed hold of that quote as something that would shape our path forward. Essentially, what we were grappling with or grabbing hold of is this idea that the struggle is actually a real part of what leads us into song, or what leads us into a beautiful moment together. So it's not that struggle or pain or hardship is going to be something that stays away from us. It's going to come. The question is, how do we lean into it? And that's sort of the way that I would say it over the last years that we've been married. How do we lean into the struggle? How do we not cower or turn away from it, but instead say that this is something that's a part of our story at the moment, and so let's actually go toward it, and let's, quote-unquote, anguish. My friend Ryan, his relationship or his marriage has a different kind of struggle than mine has or maybe ever will have. Soon after he was married, his wife was diagnosed with epilepsy, and if you're not aware of that disease, it's a really kind of a difficult disorder, and it's sensory. And essentially, you can randomly just have a loss of consciousness or convulsions. And so typically for his wife, these would happen at night. And so every night they would go to bed wondering if they would wake up in the middle of the night to an unmanageable and long-lasting seizure. And this has gone on for years. It hasn't ended. And sometimes his wife's medication is working, and sometimes it's not working, and it just seems all so unreasonable and unmanageable. And so at one point I was with him in the car, and I said to him, we were traveling somewhere together, and I was starting to say about how difficult my life felt, and I said, this is nothing. Like, you must be thinking, dude, like, you're a mess, because this is nothing like what you're going through. And he said, no, I don't ever compare suffering. And I that was the first time I'd ever thought of it, right? That it's possible for you to compare suffering. It's possible for me to compare suffering. And that's what I was doing, and that's what he was refusing to do. He had determined that he wasn't going to look at someone else's situation and say, yeah, they don't have it half as bad as me, which can lead to a woe is me or a my life is just the worst thing around. And so he was resolutely saying, I don't do that. And there's something true about that, I think, especially if you're struggling. But I want to, like, venture to say that there's a different, maybe a more grateful way of comparing suffering. And so I just want to do that briefly, and hopefully this is helpful. Sometimes I think it's good to look around and see that there are different struggles that different people go to, and to look at those struggles not in a comparative sense, but to look at them in a way that enlightens the path that's before you. So for instance, when Mother Teresa was 8, her father died. He was a wealthy owner of a construction company, and he was doing well in what is now Macedonia. It was Albania at the time. That's where she grew up. And his father was an extremely generous man. She grew up with poor people from the community eating at their table in the evenings because her family would welcome them in. So her father traveled one day, and he was very influential in his town, and when he returned, he was horribly sick, and the next day he abruptly died. And there was no real way of knowing why that happened. Her mother always suspected that he was possibly poisoned. He was at a political event, and possibly someone poisoned him. And so that's why he returned home and died. As a result of this, they lost everything. At that day, in that time, and that place, the woman had no right to her husband's wealth, and her husband's business partners were unwilling to share the wealth with her family. And so she was left basically destitute. She had nothing. And so for the next years, they were just trying to make ends meet. They went from being a family with much, a family that could be generous, to a family that was just trying to scrape by. This same sort of scenario happened in my family to my great-grandmother. My grandmother grew up in a family that had lost everything, and then her mother had no rights to anything because it was all her husband's. Like, when you look at that kind of suffering, you think, this is just baffling. Or maybe just take a different kind of step back and see that in the early 20th century, the average European lived on $2 a day. That's the average European. Like, as you go through history, the struggle is real through human history. We can do this all day long. We can look at the various things that happen in the world, and it can actually enlighten us to our circumstance. And I wonder if that kind of practice of looking around and seeing the things that happen can lead us into gratitude. Another way of doing this that kind of leans or removes us from the moment or the subjective experience of our struggle and our suffering is trying to kind of step back and see if we can achieve a more objective view of the difficulties that come before us. And so I wonder if we could categorize. It would have been nice if this was on a slide because you could kind of see, but maybe you can take notes or remember somehow. But I wonder if we could go through and just kind of put our finger on what makes different kinds of difficulties difficult. So maybe we could say that there is this one sort of difficulty which comes from unmet expectations. Unmet expectations. This is like, you know, you're in your 20s, you know, this was me, and you become reflective on things that weren't maybe perfect in your childhood. Everyone does this, right? My kids, Lord knows, are going to do this. Help them, right? But we have unmet expectations, and it can feel like pain. And so it has led many of us in our 20s into therapy, and if it hasn't led, maybe you should have. But, right, like you have this sense that it just wasn't right in some way. There was a problem, there were problems, and it feels like pain, and it's the existential experience. It's your relative experience of that that feels like wilderness or feels like struggle. And so that's one kind of way that we could be leaning into wilderness or struggle. Another is loss or death. And of course, there's the loss or death that comes from the loss of a relationship that matters immensely. All right? Some of us know all about that. There's also, I'm wondering if it could be categorized in here as well, the loss or death of a dream, of something that you anticipated could be beautiful. Here we're kind of merging those verse two, but it's kind of up to you. Where do you draw that line? Sometimes it just is the way it is, and other times it feels like something was kind of snatched from you, and it feels more cosmic or bigger in some sense. There's a different kind of suffering that comes from malevolence, is what I'm calling it. The suffering that comes from someone that is being deliberately mean to you. A bully, an abuser, someone that's out to get you, someone that did you wrong. We have a family story in my family. My parents built an addition on their house so that my mom could have a salon. She was a hairdresser growing up. And it was all approved by the township. And then someone made a problem and something happened and I don't know what, but essentially they got shut down before they even were able to open it. And there they were in their early 20s, took out a loan and couldn't open their shop. And it felt like someone was doing them wrong, right? It was something that my parents had to work through. There's a sort of suffering that comes from an intentional sort of evil, and it feels worse or different. I should say different, not worse. That's comparative. Just said I'm not doing that. Feels different. It's a different kind of suffering. Or what if it's a malevolent death? Here we're mixing. There's the suffering from malevolence that leads to death. Someone was killed, murdered. That's a different kind of death, a different kind of suffering. Or perhaps I want to say worst, but and maybe it is worst, but I'm saying I'm not going to compare, but there's the suffering of malevolence for the sake of malevolence and leading to death. And this happens in the world. This is torture. This is the Holocaust. This is gas chambers. We're going to make your life as miserable as it can possibly be until you die. We're not going to actually kill you. We're going to make you miserable. This is the world we live in. These are the kinds of wildernesses people go through. In the book of Exodus, and that's kind of the text that Joshua has been living with here for us. In the book of Exodus, there's this community of people that's going through struggle and hardship. And I want to draw your attention to the beginning of three chapters. It's Exodus 16, 17, and 19. In Exodus 16, the very beginning of the chapter, these are the first verses, and you can kind of sense as I read these that there's some similarities here, and I wonder if the writer or the speaker, because this would have been oral for many years, The speaker is drawing our attention to a pattern or a rhythm. And here's what it says in the beginning of those three chapters. The whole, chapter 16, verse 1, the whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. And on the 15th day of the second month after they came out from Egypt, in the desert, the whole community grumbled. Chapter 17, the whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Chapter 19, verse 1. On the first day of the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on that very day, they came out of the desert of Sinai. They came to the desert of Sinai after they set out from Rephidim. They entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called him from the mountain. What I want our attention to go to in these three passages, because there's this phrase that's repeated, at least in English it's repeated. It's the same thing in all three. And it's the word set out. I wonder if this can be instructive for us in our life of struggle and suffering. The word for set out in the Hebrew is nasa. Nasa. In the first two chapters, in 16 and 17, it's set out. So we have this image of the people being in one place. They're in one place, and it's a difficult place. And the writer says that they set out. They nasa. It's a verb. In 16 and 17, this verb nasa, it means to pull out or to pluck out, to uproot. It's almost as if you're a weed or a plant that's being just kind of grabbed at the bottom of the stem and pulled. Or maybe, since it's a verb, you're pulling yourself. And so they're set into motion. They set themselves into motion again. In chapter 19, the verb is different. It translates as the same thing. It's set out again. But the verb in this sense is yatsa. Yatsa. It's a different word. And this one just means to go out, to come out, to exit, or to bring out. It's just they went. You know, when you notice these things in the scripture, it's like, what do you do with it? Is it just, it just is what it is? In one sense, in the first two scenarios, they used the word, this word, and the other one, they used that word. I like to think there probably is something going on there. These stories were told over hundreds of years, repeated, and so there's maybe, perhaps, something going on there. In the first sense, I'm not a historian of these words. I don't know exactly what these words mean. But in the first sense, it seems like there's something going on that feels a little bit more traumatic. And in the second, it's a little bit more willing, a little bit less of a plucking up, and a little bit more of a just going out. I have this image in my head of the people, because remember, in all cases, we went through in those three chapters, we went through three different places. They were in this place, and then they went to this place. And then they were in that place, and they went to another place. And then they were in that place, and they went to another place. They never left the desert. They were in the wilderness the entire time. They were struggling the entire time. But we have this call for them to pick themselves up and move forward somehow. And so they do it. They set out. They pick themselves up and they somehow move forward. Psychotherapy, one of the most significant ways that you can help someone who is struggling with some sort of fear or anxiety is to get them to voluntarily approach that fear or anxiety. So for instance, if you are deathly afraid of needles, you might, in conversing with your therapist, agree to let a needle into the room and sit on the shelf while you talk. And you know it's there, you see it's there, maybe you just look away, but you're at least willingly entering a room with a needle, and there it is. And maybe the next meeting, the needle comes down, and it's on the table beside, and it's there, and you're not touching it. You're not really even looking, but it's there. And then the next time, the needle comes, and it's actually in front of you in the hands of the other person, and you just are a little bit more peripherally aware of it, until pretty soon it's in your hand. This is totally impossible to overcome a fear or anxiety if the fear or anxiety is thrust upon you. How many of us learn to love water by being just tossed into the deep end? Very few. It's sort of a traumatic thing. You can't be forced into the fear. You have to voluntarily go to it. And so we're told that Israel set out. They were called, and they voluntarily set out. They went into their fear. They didn't stay where they were. They went toward it. In the scripture that I read this morning to start off our morning, we're told that we're told that Jesus resolutely, the scripture said, resolutely set out for Jerusalem. He was going to Jerusalem. It's like, in Jesus' mind, this is where I'm going. So he sends people ahead of him, and they run into struggle or hardship. By the way, before we get to that point, the scripture says that the time was coming for him to go up into heaven or something, or ascend. Various translations translate it differently. This is, we know, like, while that's perhaps true, it's a flowery way of saying he was going to die, right? Like, Jesus was not setting out to Jerusalem thinking of being taken up into heaven. He was going to Jerusalem aware that he was going to suffer brutally and die. That's what was happening sociopolitically in the moment, right? Jesus could see it coming. So Jesus resolutely goes into the pain. And the disciples run into a smaller sort of hardship, we might say. They were not welcomed in a town. Jesus had on his mind that he was going to suffer brutally. Along the way, they were unwelcomed, which is a sort of malevolence, we might say, right? As you kind of think about the different ways that we suffer, it's a sort of malevolence, but it's not a malevolence unto death, and it's not a torturous sort of malevolence for the sake of malevolence until you die. It's just malevolence. And so they run into this, and the disciples are like, oh no, bro. Jesus, we can call down some fire on these jokers. And Jesus is like, not into it. I'm drawn to this whole episode because Jesus is resolutely going into the suffering, and the disciples have a sort of anxiety about it. Part of what I, at least my experience has been, is that there's this sense in which we struggle with our own sort of wilderness, but there's also this sense in which it's something that is lived alongside other people. And so how do we do that? How do we live with other people while we are suffering? Or how do we live with other people while they are suffering? Because it's one thing just for you to be on your own and struggling with a host of things, difficulties at work, a boss who's unreasonable, a bank account that's not where you had hoped it would be at this point in your life. Things feel difficult or like pain, like hardship. But how do we do that when there's someone else in the mix? The disciples show us perhaps what not to do. Operate with like this anxious, I'll solve this sort of thing, which I'm really good at that, like in my own relationship with Chelsea. Like, she sometimes just wants to be heard, and here I am charting the path forward for us. Like, well, here's how we get beyond this. And she's just like, dude, like, just let me talk. It's like, I'm like, let's call down fire and solve this thing. Instead, I wonder if it's perhaps better for us to be listening a little bit more and also be collaborating with each other on what it could look like for us to move forward together. So one of the more helpful or healthy practices that we've set into motion in our family is we'll, and I should say that I do this because I'm a fairly volatile human being. I will, when I get home, and sometimes this happens, maybe this happens to you too, I'll get home from work and like just go straight to the dishes, or after dinner just kind of be in a funk and then go to the dishes, and I'm like scrubbing them like there's death on them, like, you know, like you're just so like irritated or frustrated. I just get like that sometimes. And so the question that I've started to ask myself is, like, if I can locate my stress, like, where is this coming from? Sometimes it can just feel like there's all kinds of things, or there's something swirling in your head, and there maybe are various scenarios that are adding to it. But if you can kind of put your finger on the thing that's pushing you over the edge right now, not only is work stressful, but then this person that I rarely see said something that seems somewhat passive aggressive, and it just grinds on me right now. If you can just locate that, this is what it is, then it just kind of like naming it or seeing it releases it a little bit. If you can say it to the person, you know, I'm really frustrated right now because I thought I was going to win this project and it just didn't happen. Or I'm really frustrated right now because the kids were just yelling at me all day is how it felt. And then you can kind of see where it is, and we can together say, okay, that's the difficulty right now. That's the thing that's before us. The other thing that we do sometimes is we'll share need froms. Sometimes I know I've already located it, and I'll come in the door and I'm struggling, and I'll be like, can we share need froms? This is what I need from you. Can you tell me what you need from me right now in order for us to have a good evening? Right? And if we can say like, man, I just really need to go for a quick run, or man, I just need 20 minutes laying on the bed with my eyes closed alone. We can just kind of take inventory. This is what I can give to you. This is what you can give to me. And I think we'll be okay. The last thing that I'll say is sometimes we just decide to set out. It's just like what we see with the Israelites, and it's also what we see with Jesus. We decide that we're going to go through it. I like when we do this. I have to do it. Sometimes Chelsea does it, and sometimes we got to get our kids to do it too. We'll just say we'll say something to the effect of, you know, I think that we need to talk about this, but let's talk about it later, and let's just have a really good evening together. We'll just decide this is going to be a good evening. This is going to be a good day. And then we'll go back to it later. Or perhaps it was just so minuscule and trivial that we've learned that we can just leave it be. We can just leave it be. When we're struggling, there's this thing that we do that's called self-differentiating. This is a fancy psychological term that I picked up from some therapist somewhere. It essentially means that you see yourself as distinct from the person that you're walking with. You don't let their struggle completely become your own. You don't empathize with them to the extent that you can't see a distinction between yourself and them. You don't submerge personalities. Submerge, merge would be the word. Submerge is under, merge is together. You don't merge personalities. Instead, you see each other as distinct, and you say to the other, I'm with you, I want to walk with you, but I'm also not going to just become you in this situation. What that also allows for is for the opportunity for the two of you to chart a path forward together as partners rather than as people that are just struggling collectively. This is all very marital, suddenly. I'm just noticing as I'm saying this. Right, because it's like when you walk with someone, you just have a lot of struggle. And so if you're not married, perhaps the struggle feels a little bit different. Perhaps it feels like you're a little bit more alone, or you don't know who you share it with. Hopefully there's something in there that can be applied or grappled with for you. There's this word nerve that I really like. And I like it when it comes to walking through difficulty. Nerve is typically, like my mom would say to me growing up, well, you have nerve for saying that. But nerve is really about courage or gumption. It's really about like deciding that you're going to do something. And I actually, when I looked up this word, I realized that it can actually be a verb. You can nerve yourself to do something. And what I'm seeing in the scripture, what I'm seeing in the Israelite community, and what I'm seeing in Jesus in Luke 9 is this willingness to nerve yourself in the face of adversity, to see that life is going to have difficulty, life is going to have struggle, and that you are going to stand up and set out to pluck yourself up and to go forward, and that God can give you the grace to do that. I was really glad when our first year was over. Frankly, I was glad when our 20s was over. I felt like, I just said this to Chelsea this morning, I feel like my entire 20s was one big wilderness, because it's just like, you don't know who you are, you don't know what you're doing, you're trying to figure out how to be a friend to your friends and a spouse to your spouse, and like it just feels like really hard. But then we came into year 11. This is our 11th year together, Chelsea and I. And year 11, we have decided together, has been easily the most difficult year of our married life, right? Like, it's like you just don't know when it's going to get you. There's this really, really overused quote that I've seen ascribed to Socrates, but I looked it up, and some Scotsman, I believe, from the 20th century said it. His name's Ian McLaren. "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle." I think that's real. It's oversaid because it's probably really true. That's how most cliches work. So I leave you with three practices. Locate your stress, share your need-froms, and then just set out. Set out into the journey. The Christian story leads you there. Jesus leads you there. Jesus walks there with you. So go.